Welcome to the Alcohol Free Life podcast, brought to you by thesoberclub.com. I'm Genuinely Grace. This is for you if you've quit the booze or you'd like to, or maybe you're just sober curious. I'll bring you tips and motivation without any judgment, and there'll be inspiration from experts, quitlet authors, and sober heroes. Hi and welcome to the podcast. How are you doing? I hope you've had a good week. I got lots of feedback last week after my massive rant about that study in the press about alcohol being good for you and particularly helping you avoid cataract surgery. That was I did have a bit of a rant. I'd apologise. Someone said that they thought I was going to jump out of their phone. That we're listening to the podcast on. I'm going to tell you about something else I've seen in the press this week, which I'm sure you have as well, that I'm not going to rant about at all, actually. In fact, I haven't quite got my head around it, if truth be told. I just thought I'd share it with you. I'd be really interested to know your views. It's this story that Demi Lovato has revealed her decision to be California sober. That's her expression, California sober. And according to her, that seems to mean that she has moderate amounts of alcohol and marijuana. And I mean, this has caused one hell of a storm, it would seem. A lot of people are criticizing her. I think her own manager, according to some reports, Elton John, who she's referred to as one of her recovery mentors, have basically come out and said, you know, we don't think this is a good idea. People are criticizing her of being a hypocrite because, one blog that I read, the guy quoted a couple of her song lyrics, which I hadn't been aware of, but apparently in Dancing with the Devil, one of the verses one of the tracks starts with, "It's just a little red wine, it'll be fine. Not like I want to do this every night. I've been good, don't I deserve it? I think I earned it, feels like it's worth it." And then she moves on to say, "It's just a little white line," and et cetera. So there's a lot of calling out of Demi Lovato here, and people are saying, you know, effectively, this is hypocrisy. It's absolute hypocrisy to be, heralding yourself as an example, and using the word sober, I think, is what's really made people fed up. So there's quite a big old backlash against Demi from people in the recovery community who find this, you know, concerning. And then at the other end of the spectrum, there are people like Dr. Adi Jaffe, who, interestingly enough, is my guest on the podcast next week. It's a fantastic interview that I look forward to bringing you. But he, as you will find out when you listen to our discussion, has a very different take on abstinence. And, you know, his attitude is that there isn't anything else that we consider that, you know, has to be full abstinence, kind of from the off, as it were. He says perhaps the world's been wrong about recovery, that it has to be full abstinence from everything. So he says, you know, maybe people are freaking out about the way Demi Lovato told the world her recovery is not the traditional way that we, you know, kind of expect it to be. And as he says quite rightly, we don't know exactly what she meant by being California sober. We don't know how happy she is about that. We don't know whether it genuinely works for her. And as he says, you know, the only thing that really matters is that whatever approach you're taking works for you. So I'm just throwing that out there at you, really. For once, I don't actually have a big old rant to deliver. Safe to say, I suppose what I would say is I would keep going back to that same question, asking her and anyone who wants to consider themselves California sober, ask yourself, would my life be better physically and emotionally without the booze? And if the answer is no, I'm good, I'm absolutely good with the amount I'm having, all good, then absolutely knock yourself out. It's just that the majority of people that listen to this podcast or join the Sober Club or contact me or follow the work that I do, have at some point gone through periods of abstinence. They've stopped drinking. They've felt so much better. It's off the scale. And then the wine witch has come along and said, oh, you've got this, you're good, may as well just have another drink. And then it's rather than reaching a nice sort of what they consider a nice path of moderation and becoming mindful drinkers, in many cases they've gone straight back down the booze elevator extremely quickly, and it's been pretty disastrous. And then they're back, back again. Just this week in the Sober Club, one member said, I haven't been here for a while, I haven't connected for a while. That's always quite telling, because that's the first thing people do when they decide to, go back to drinking often, is disconnect from the people around them who have been supporting them. But she said, I haven't been around for a while. I had a decent number of days under my belt, was starting to feel great. Things were changing, things were on the mend. Then I had some stress in my life regarding, family stuff. And thought, well, I've got this. One glass will be fun. Had one glass, and before you know it, absolutely full on again. Felt utterly miserable, utterly fed up with herself, utterly stupid. Actually, is how she described herself, and was totally berating herself. Her message, her overriding message, was, if you're reading this and you're thinking about going back to drinking, don't do it. It's so not worth it. So for her, if I ask that question, do you really believe that your life is better without the booze, physically and emotionally? The answer is hell yes. So it comes back to that. It really does come back to, what do you really know in your heart and your gut is the right path for you? And if it's mindful drinking, then yeah, cool. Although I do always say, put some rules in place. Don't ever have a drink when you're feeling massively stressed or fearful or angry, because that will, start all those associations going again. Anyways, there you go. Demi Lovato is California sober. I don't suppose she'll be coming on the podcast anytime soon. Otherwise, I'd ask her about it. But you never know. As I say, next week, my guest is Dr. Adi Jaffe. So I'm so looking forward to sharing that with you, because, his work is amazing. And he has some controversial ideas, but I'm always good to cover all kinds of stuff on this podcast. And that brings me to today's guest, who again is not the kind of thing I'd necessarily always cover on this show, but I just got quite inspired reading about Helen Garlick, who is a former lawyer turned author. She's written her memoir, and I was reading about the fact that she herself got sober while she was writing her memoir in lockdown. I've read the book. I absolutely loved the book. It's sort of in equal measures to kind of also finding it so moving that I was kind of, reading it behind a cushion, one of those. The book tackles very tricky topics. So, trigger warning here, really, in that it's about suicide. We can tell you that straight away. The book's called No Place to Lie, Secrets Unlocked, and A Promise Kept. And it tells the story of her brother. You'll hear it all in the interview. But I just wanted to give you a heads up that it is an emotional story, and of course we do discuss the fact that she says she really didn't want this to be a depressing, miserable kind of memoir, although the subject is incredibly serious, and she does look at the whole stigma around suicide and the shame and the guilt and all of the stuff that can come with it for the family. She wanted to, introduce some humour into it, and she does. She does it in a really beautiful way, actually. I just thought the work that she's doing is great. There's a tremendous amount of hope in the story. I absolutely loved the book. So, anyways, I hope you enjoy the interview.
My guest is Helen Garlick, the author of an extraordinary debut memoir, No Place to Lie, about the corrosive effect of family secrets. Oh, this is just such a story, Helen. Thank you so much for joining me. We're going to talk a bit more about your background, obviously, the fact that you were a family lawyer and mediator for over 35 years, and you now describe yourself as a courage builder. So we'll definitely talk about that as well. Just before we get into the book, just tell us a little bit about you, a little bit about your life. I think it's nice to kind of imagine who we're talking to.
Yeah, hi, Jenny. It's lovely to be here. Thank you so much for inviting me on. Okay, so I live in Sussex these days. I come from Yorkshire, born in Doncaster. And live on the edge of the South Downs, which actually been incredibly lucky in lockdown to be able to march out there with our dogs, Pippin and Ziggy Stardust. We had a litter of puppies last year, so Ziggy we kept. And then I've got three children, young adults, and two bonus daughters. So, yeah, that's a bit about my kind of personal life.
So you were a lawyer for many years, family lawyer, and then more recently you've been spearheading a collaborative practice training for resolution, yeah? So mediation kind of stuff, I guess.
Well, mediation and, yeah, there's a special type of family law called collaborative law where a separating couple and each of their lawyers all sign up to an agreement saying they're not going to go to court and they are going to sort it out by agreement. So it's a form of talking solution where you're committed to agreement. You know, and if the sort of solutions that you can get through agreements are just worlds better than the ones that the courts force on you. You can do it at your own pace. You can talk about what the things that are important to you, most definitely the children, and how the solution is going to work for everybody. So it's a talking solution. It's really good. It's actually internationally known now, but it's very strong in the UK. And if anybody's ever thinking about separating or divorce, it's a great way forward.
Yeah, we'll talk more about that in a while, because, you know, well, I'm sure you won't be surprised to know that it can be a big thing, actually. A lot of people who, you know, their lives change, they get sober and lots of things change. And not least, they finally find the courage to extract themselves from something that they hasn't probably felt right in years and years and years. And so then at that point, but they're coming from a different place to the one they would have been coming from, as it were, 10 years previously, where it would have all been anger and animosity. And actually, I've spoken to some people who really do want to separate, but they really want to do it in a way that is as amicable as possible and as kind as possible. So it seems to me that work's super important.
It's huge, isn't it? I mean, yeah, I think especially when you've gone sober, but I mean, for all of us, you know, it's good to be present with what's happening in our lives. And when you do kind of have that, you know, I mean, I've been sober now for more or less a year, and I don't know, it's just you feel things, you see things in a different way, and you're probably living your life much closer to your true inner values than you know, things that you thought you ought to do, you should do. Those, you know, two really bad words. If we kind of live our lives according to what we ought or should do, it's we're going in the wrong direction. So yeah, I think that it's potentially kind of way forward. You get talking about things so you can do things, you can do it creatively. And I've had clients in the past who've come to me who said they wanted to do their divorce with love. One was a yoga teacher and one was a psychologist, and they just, you know, they wanted to do it in a better way.
Because I think, you know,
if you're sort of thinking about in the future, when you looking back on your life and you're making these decisions now, what you try and do is the ones that you'll feel comfortable with, you know, that actually fit you, who you are as an individual, but also take other people's thoughts into account as well. So yeah, it's a good way forward.
Yeah, definitely. So you ditched the booze while you were writing the book. Tell us, we'll get on to more about that, but tell us a bit about this book then, because you know, well, as we said in the intro there, you're sharing a family secret, you know, family secrets, and you know, sort of laying it all out there, warts and all. So why did you decide to write this story now? It feels very, a very brave thing to do.
Thank you. The key part of the story, which was about what had happened when my brother died in 1981, I'd promised myself back in 1981, so that's what, 40 years ago now, that I would write this story. And it was just that I could not write it until my parents actually had both died.
Right.
Might sound a bit dramatic, but I felt it would be too exposing, too cruel for them to be forced to look at what had really happened. And yet for me, it was incredibly important to piece together the story about what had happened. You know, my brother took his own life, and I knew that he'd done that because I'd talked to his friends. And I actually had a relationship with his best friend who had also been talking about his taking his life too. So I knew that David, my brother, and the person I call in the book, Nick Kane, had been talking about this. I wanted to have a look at it because, you know, suicide is such a taboo subject. It's people almost worry that if you say the word, it's going to happen to somebody else.
Yeah.
Whereas nowadays, you know, once you start looking at what the signs are for people, which is a really useful thing to do. There's a brilliant charity called Zero Suicide Alliance that I'm going to be doing some work with in future. And they do this fantastic free training to find out, you know, to help you work out what are the signs of somebody who is thinking about it, suicidal ideation, it's sometimes called, and how to have those conversations with them. Mm. So they're a brilliant charity. If you look them up, you know, you can do that training. So going back to the book, I wanted to write that story. I had to wait until my parents had died, Janie, and then my dad died in 2014, my mum in 2017, and then she took another huge secret to her grave. And I thought, okay, I'm going to have to write about that too. And it was an issue for me. Should I write two books or try and put the both of them together? But I felt there was a really strong link, because both are about secrets. And I think, you know, when you do keep a secret, it cuts you off from other people, doesn't it? You're sort of living more in your own world. And I think, and I'm not the only one, it's so much more important to kind of live your life more openly and to be, you know, to be out there and present and not feel that you've got to keep these things, these secrets down. I think they can have a horrible toxic effect on you. So that's why I felt it was important to write the book.
It must have been quite a thing writing. I mean, did you find it cathartic to write it all down, or was it agonizing?
I think it was cathartic. I went through different phases in it. I think probably the first 6 months I started just writing about my mum being in a care home, where she was for the last few days of her life before she unexpectedly died. And that I really needed to get out somewhere, because it was very difficult and very painful, but it wasn't really the material for a book, you know. It was almost like I was kind of circling around a volcanic crater, you know, going round and round, and then realizing actually I've got to get into the hot bit, you know, the stuff that's more powerful, that hurts potentially. But once you kind of dive down in there and you see it for what it is, then it helps. So I experienced a range of different things. And the very strange thing was, when I was writing the book towards the end, it was almost as if the book was writing itself through me. So all I'd have to do was just turn up, and then the words would flow. And then it would wake me up at 3 o'clock in the morning and go, Helen, you've missed out that bit. Chapter 24, get back to it. So, yeah, it really flowed. And I'm really glad it's done and it's out there in the world.
I mean, I haven't finished the book, so I can't have any spoilers. Don't spoil it for me. Okay. I should have tried to finish it before this interview. But the truth of it is, I'm really enjoying it. And so I'm eking it out. Do you ever do that with books? You eke them out. I am enjoying it. Although it's quite raw, isn't it? It's dark. It has some darkness. And what I found, you know, really fascinating was when you you really paint the most beautifully vivid pictures. You're a fabulous writer. I mean, I don't know what you've been doing being a lawyer all these years. I mean, I'm sure we need you as a lawyer, but you're a sensational writer.
Thank you.
But, you know, you paint such a vivid picture of your childhood. You know, I can practically taste the biscuits you're eating. And you've obviously very close relationship with your brother. So it must have been absolutely devastating for you. When you look back, as I say, I haven't got far enough in the book yet to know the answer to this, but for everyone's sake, looking back now, was that tendency, was that thought process something that you think David would have had as a child or not?
Well, I didn't think so. I mean, David and I were really close. I was the older sister and we were really close when we were especially little. And he was just this sunny, beautiful boy with blonde hair, freckles, blue eyes. Frankly, he could get away with murder. He'd just smile and then everybody would go, "Oh, David." So we were really, really close. And he didn't really bother talking. We had our own language.
I find that very fascinating in the book.
A couple of people have said to me, do you think that maybe he had some kind of learning difficulty or was he on the spectrum? Or and it's possible. I mean, those sorts of words weren't around when I was growing up in Yorkshire. It's possible, but he just, you know, he kind of lived a very sunny life. When I've kind of researched the book and I talked to some of his friends, and one of them confided in me something that he hadn't told anybody else. And so Christopher and David used to play at Ivanhoe in the gardens and, you know, pretend that they were medieval knights and all that kind of stuff. But David once said to Christopher when he was about 10 or 11, "I don't want to live beyond 20. I don't like the thought of being old. I don't like old people. I don't want to be old." And Christopher had just said, "Oh, that's ridiculous, David. You know, we all, I don't know if he said ridiculous, but, you know, he was just saying to him, don't be silly." And he never dared tell anybody about that. So, but that obviously from quite a young age was in my brother's head that he didn't want to live. But I never knew that.
Right.
And when he did take his own life, I'd been in the States for 2 months. I'd taken a sort of 3 month gap in between studying to be a lawyer and then kind of starting my legal career. And I was going around America, down to Mexico, and had this amazing trip. But I didn't know what was going on for him, you know. And looking at the time, I felt as so many people do, everybody, I would say, who's been involved with somebody who's taken their own life, was it my fault? I the one who was guilty?
And it's an interesting one, that, isn't it? And your parents as well, with the bits that I've read, were, well, kind of in denial, really.
Yeah, I think they couldn't take it on board. I think it would have been just too hard. You know, it's incredibly, you know, you can't find the words for it, about saying how hard it is to carry on after somebody else has died in that way, and especially as a parent. My dad took refuge in the idea that it must have been an accident, or maybe even David had been murdered. And he fought against the original inquest verdict of suicide, and there was a second inquest, and the verdict of that was an open verdict, so they didn't know what had happened. And he, you know, David hadn't left a note, but he had done other things. He was looking after my dog. And he'd made sure that the dog was going to be looked after by somebody else. And apparently that's one of the signs that you need to look out for.
I mean, I don't have stats in front of me, but I'm sure you will have noticed I don't think I had heard the word suicide, certainly not to the extent I've heard it this year. Yeah. I mean, the suicide rates I've read are off the scale over the last year because of lockdowns and stuff.
I think it's very hard to know what the actual, you know, technical figures will be, because sometimes it takes a while for them to surface. You know, sometimes there are inquests, sometimes, you know, there's kind of examination of what had happened. But, you know, yes, they do go up. Yes, it's very likely that they will have gone up. Actually, partly, Janie, because of this terrible thing of being isolated.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, that's the very worst thing that we can do to ourselves as human beings. And there's loads of studies now which show that isolation is the key killer. So yeah. Underneath it all is this isolation. And we need connection. Mm. We thrive on it. And we really, you know, we actually perish if we don't have it. And so that's what I think is one of the most worrying things. I mean, we can reach out to people through text or on the phone, or preferably, you know, but speaking to them, hearing their voice, letting them hear your voice is so much better. But it's really tough, isn't it? You know, across the world, everybody's facing this of not being able to hug people and tell them we love them and, you know, and tell them they matter to us. That's so important.
Yeah. In the book, you describe your early childhood and the dynamic with your parents, and there was definitely some alcohol involved, to say the least, wasn't there? Your parents were drinkers.
Yeah, they were. It was sort of like the 70s. They hadn't actually drunk when they were young adults. They didn't really start drinking until they got married to one another. But in the 70s. It felt very racy, you know, pretty cool to be drinkers.
That's when women started drinking more as well, didn't they? Yeah. There were the baby shams and whatever.
Well, the baby shams and the black velvet or something, I think. But, you know, I mean, I used to pride myself of being able to drink pretty much under anybody else under the table. Mm. You know, my parents gave us wine from a very early age to accustom ourselves to it so that we would know how to deal with it. But I mean, you know, it's just like, I'm just going to give you a little bit of rat poison so that you're going to deal with it. You know,
exactly.
It's bonkers,
just
isn't
a bit
it?
So, of heroin to get you used to it. Yeah,
exactly. So there was a lot of alcohol around. My dad drank pretty much every day until he fell over at a very elderly age and broke his hip. And then when he went into hospital, he basically went into cold turkey when he was probably about 78. But my grandmother, also my mum's mum, used to open a bottle of Anjou Rosé every morning and at about 10:30, 11, and then would drink it the rest of the day. So you know not to contact granny between 10 and 3. Mm. And now, you know, all of this, Janie, was just like normal.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? So like that was what we were. We were drinkers. We were cool. Mm. And it was then in writing the memoir, and I was writing that, I was thinking, this is just so not right, you know, and what were they doing to their bodies? What am I doing to my body? Not that I was a heavy drinker, but I would, you know, there would always be a bottle of wine in the fridge and I'd think of it as my mate, you know, my friend.
Before we even get into that more, just tell me about the drinking scene, if you like, among lawyers, because you know, for every industry, you know, people are always saying to me, oh, you're in the media, they're the worst for drinking. And then I did a TED talk and it was it was organized by a whole bunch of lecturers in Norwich. And they were saying, no, the teachers and lecturers, they're the biggest drinkers. And then of course, everyone was, oh, no, lawyers are the biggest drinkers. So what's the deal in that kind of career?
I certainly think lawyers do drink a lot. And I think, you know, family law is actually quite a tough thing to be involved in because one's got aspirations and intentions to make it amicable. There's some pretty grim stuff that goes on as well. You know, you can hear about abuse, violence, children being neglected, children being played off one against the other. You know, some really tough things that family lawyers have to deal with. And they're not always that good at getting supervision or, you know, just being able to offload it. So, yeah, there's a lot of drinking. I mean, the family law conferences, there would always be people, you know, drinking really heavily. Very, very heavily, and getting absolutely smashed as well. But nobody saying, "Oh my God, you know, you're smashed."
Not caught, never caught.
That was normal. Mm. And if anybody did say, "Oh no, I'll have a soft drink," then it'd be, "Well, why are you doing that?" So nowadays, I think, you know, when somebody questions me why am I having a soft drink, you think, "Well, why are you drinking alcohol?" You know, it's the wrong way around. Mm. So there's a lot of drinking that goes on. I think in the 80s as well, you know, if you met up with another lawyer for lunch, a bottle of wine would be open. Mm. So, and then maybe a second one. Mm. So you'd have a bottle of wine at lunchtime and then probably something in the evening as well.
Yeah. Yeah. And I'm guessing as well, in addition to that, I'm guessing that, over the years as a family lawyer, you would have noticed the part that alcohol played in so many breakups, not least the effect on the kids.
Yeah. I think that's true. In terms of like really heavy drinking, but I think the trouble is that as many family lawyers are also drinking, then you kind of almost, there's a kind of collusion in it. You don't necessarily notice, you know, you're not necessarily as attuned to it because you think there's a kind of normal level of drinking, which might be say half a bottle of wine because that's what you're doing. Mm. Whereas, you know, I mean, I think one of the things that I've just so discovered when I'm sober is that you're present.
Yeah.
You know, you're showing up there and you feel all the feelings. So you can't just go, well, actually, you know what? I don't really want to have that feeling. I just, exactly. You know, can I just stick with the happiness bit? But no, you know, you deal with all the feelings, but you're present. You're seeing what's going on. Mm. And maybe that's why, you know, coming back to your earlier point, that people, when they go through their sobriety journey, when they start getting sober, they wake up and go, I can't actually be with this person in future because it's having a toxic effect on me, never mind the alcohol.
Yeah, exactly. So when you, at what point did you make your decision then and you know, to stop and were you surprised that, you know, how difficult or how easy it was for you?
Well, there were a couple of things that actually really had a big impact on me. One was I got back in touch with the person I called Nick Kane in the book. And I was worried about that because he's a sheep farmer, a lot of drinking there as well. And he used to drink a lot when I knew him, which was back in the early 80s. But I'd recorded something for Woman's Hour about these family secrets, and I knew it was going to come out. And he might have heard it on the radio. I didn't want him to hear, you know, me talking about this before I'd notified him. So we spoke on the phone, and he told me that he got sober 15 years ago when he'd met his second wife. First marriage was a disaster. And I thought, wow, if Nick can do it, that's amazing. Because, you know, he's kind of a bit like Heathcliff, only blonde hair and green eyes. You know, I just never thought he would end up being sober. And then I've also got a wonderful friend called Barbara Mills, who's a barrister, QC mediator. And we met up in Kew in the Palm House. And I had actually had a sober Christmas, but I'd had some drinks the night before because it was one of my bonus daughter's big birthdays. And I met up with Barbara and she just said, you know, well, I've been sober now for 2 years and, you know, it's easy, actually. You just stop. Oh, OK. So I did. And then I wouldn't say I did find it easy. I think that's those first 30 days are harder, and there are still quite a few triggers for me. And, you know, frankly, Janie, I've been grateful for lockdown because there's been less
temptation. You've been in a bubble.
I mean,
use of the word. Yeah,
exactly. So I have fallen off the wagon a couple of times. The last time was on the 2nd of October when it was my elder daughter's engagement party. And I thought I should, that wretched word again, have a glass of champagne. So, so I suppose, you know, the 3rd of October is my sober day. But I think ultimately it's whether you're sober today or not, isn't it? That's the most important thing. So
do you think it had an impact on the book that you wrote?
Good question. Yes. As I saw it through clearer eyes, you know, instead of thinking, oh, there's Granny and she's just having a glass of two of wine. Yeah, I was thinking that's actually pretty heavy stuff that you're drinking a bottle of Anjou Rosé a day. And then I was thinking of, you know, because I think when you want to try and understand somebody, you need to hop up to the generation above, don't you, to find out what's going on there. Mm. And my aunt and I, she was sharing discussions about my granny, and I realized that she must have been physically abused by her father, who was a headmaster in Doncaster before then. And so her drinking was to kind of get away from that. Mm. Even decades later. So it is a different book. It's been done through clearer eyes.
It's really interesting you raise that. I mean, a lot of the work that I do as a coach, I don't dig deep into it, but we always end up looking at the kind of layers of the adverse childhood experiences. And I'm sure you're aware of the ACE study, you know, ACE. For anyone who hasn't heard of it, it's basically unbelievably fascinating to me that when you do a kind of mini quiz, as it were, of what your adverse childhood experiences were, we don't have to be talking about serious abuse or sexual abuse or the things that anyone would consider as being, you know, 100% an adverse effect. It can be much more subtle than that. It can be not feeling you were enough. And it can be much more subtle. And yet, I can't remember the statistic, but it's something unbelievable. Like 80% of people who score even a few on this list become addicted to something.
You're quite right. I think it's there's 14 questions, aren't there? And if you score five or more, you will, you know, you're heading for addiction.
Yeah,
you're heading for worse health. And one of the questions is, were you criticized regularly?
Exactly. Exactly.
And which again is something that it came up in the book, that my dad would say to my brother, "You stupid boy," because. Yeah. He thought that would motivate my brother to work, whereas all my brother was hearing is, "You're stupid, you're stupid, you're stupid." So it's I'm so pleased that you work with that question.
I do, because I find it really fascinating, because very often, you know, when we start talking about drinking, there's this sense of shame and guilt that we sort of think to ourselves, well, you know, I'm quite a bright person, you know, and I care about health. And how did I get caught in this? You know, even if we're not talking rock bottom, I'm talking grey area drinkers. How did I get caught up in this for so many years? Why did this happen to me? I'm so stupid. And sometimes if you're able to see, this isn't your, in inverted commas, fault. You know, this was as a result of adverse childhood experiences. However, of course, it's not your fault, but it is actually your responsibility to look at it now.
Absolutely.
And that's where you've got to do the brave bit, right? You can't just go, well, everything was crap and therefore I'm going to drink myself to death. Yeah, yeah. Well, you can, and obviously some people do. But, you know, the beauty is in letting yourself off the hook, but then being able to look at it and have that acceptance.
And absolutely. That's a phrase I often use, is it's not your fault, but it is your responsibility now. And I think, there's that... I mean, I'm a great fan of Brené Brown, and she talks about one route through, which is you're either victim or Viking. So you either kind of take it all in and go, poor me, feel sorry for yourself, or you kind of go out and be aggressive. Whereas actually what we need to do is be courageous and allow ourselves to be vulnerable and tell our stories, because it's only in talking it all through I think, you know, in a safe space that you discover yourself, that you actually, you know, you can see what happened to you through clear eyes, and you can be, you know, very loving and kind to yourself and gentle with yourself about, actually, it's, you know, this was really tough shit that I went through.
Absolutely.
And I think I've done brilliantly in even surviving, but
exactly.
Let's just now take it to a different level, which is about thriving and you know, opening up to the kind of the joy of living in your body in this extraordinary time that we are living.
And I think, you know, as well, when people have properly stepped into that new identity of who they really are without the booze, you know, that they've been kind of covering up their real self all these years.
Yeah.
From that place of knowing who you really are, most of us actually start to like ourselves a bit more, you know, people who've been in self-loathing for years. But from that place, you can make better decisions and be kinder. And that, you know, brings us back to the, you know, the work you've done around relationships, of course. I must ask you about your phrase, being a courage builder. What do you mean by that?
Well, what I think it is, I mean, courage has always been important to me. And, you know, going back to Brené Brown, she says something along the lines of, you can choose comfort or courage, but not both. And that was important for me when I was writing the book and I'd have been talking about it, because it hasn't always felt like a very comfortable place. You know, sometimes I'd far rather be, you know, like the child I was underneath a willow tree with my books and my dog and just letting the world go away. But I think it is important to blaze pathways to talk about our stories and to be vulnerable and say it's okay. You know, actually, you can talk about this stuff and you don't die. You know, actually, it's important to own it and to have agency over it. So, I mean, Brené Brown also talks about stepping into the arena. I wish she'd used a different analogy, because it's like, I really don't want to be a gladiator. Do you know what I mean? It's never going to end well, is it? The lions are going to win. But it is something about stepping out there into the world and owning the stories that you want to share and sharing them. And we know that, you know, there's such a commonality of human experience in many ways. And when we tell our stories and ask our questions, it'll resonate with somebody somewhere. There are billions of people on the planet, and we can help other people by owning our truth and kind of grabbing it and taking agency over our own life story and what's going to happen to us in future.
Mm. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's that power of connection again, isn't it? Yeah. I'm interested in this work that you're doing, this walk to fundraise for charities.
Yes. Well, that's now 2023.
Right. Okay.
Because we've got a family wedding next year. So we've had to put it back, like so many people. So, but we're going to walk from Land's End. My husband, Tim, and I are going to walk from Land's End to John O'Groats.
Wow.
With our dogs, Pippin and Ziggy Stardust. And we're going to stop off en route in village halls or football stadium, you never know, to talk about the importance of talking. So to talk about family secrets and what effect they have on you, and the importance of talking, and actually how you can talk in a safe space, and you know how to make sure, make it okay for you. So that's the plan.
So this is to fundraising for charities that are dedicated to suicide prevention and wellbeing.
Yes. Yeah. Yes. I'll be fundraising for Zero Suicide Alliance. Tim will be fundraising for Grief Encounter, which is a nice charity which helps where a child has died in, you know, a young child has died or parents have died. They help the family kind of deal with that tragedy. Mm. And again, through a talking therapy, and we'll probably raise money for Samaritans as well, because Samaritans just a terrific organisation. You know they're there.
Yeah.
So, Silver Lining Tour, we will be setting off probably on the 1st of March 2023. And if you want us to be on your village hall or wherever en route, we're really happy to talk about it. It's one of the things I've found about the book, is I've had so many amazing messages, letters, emails and so on from people, and it seems to unlock things for readers. And then they want to tell their story as well. So I'm hoping that, you know, we will, I mean, I'm sure that's happening anyway, but you know, it'd be nice to create fun, safe spaces for people to be sharing what's happened.
Yeah. What would your tip be then, or your advice, you know, for anyone who's sort of listening to this and thinking, you know, I'm worried about someone in my family, or you know, there's a family dynamic that I'm concerned about. What would you recommend?
Yeah. Well, okay. So I think writing it down to start off with, then just starts that whole process of kind of getting it out there, and it's better out than in. So start writing it down. Write down what your worries are. I mean, if you're worried about a family member, then going back to Zero Suicide Alliance training, that is brilliant. It's got so much wisdom in there that I can't possibly tell you it all here. But you know, share your concerns, and it's usually better to ask. You know, you might have all sorts of worries about asking, but it's better to ask. And then if somebody just says, "Oh, I'm fine," you know, "Don't worry about me," ask again, and ask in a different way. Even say, "Look, I'm sorry, but I just feel that there's something going on. So would you like to talk about it? Because I'm really here for you and you matter to me." I think telling somebody that you matter to them is actually really helpful.
Absolutely. And finally, then, for you, what are the top benefits of sobriety?
Oh, well, my tie around my tummy is definitely disappearing. Not as fast as I'd like, but it is definitely disappearing. There's that kind of like guilt-free waking up in the morning. It's like you wake up and you don't have to go, oh, did I say? Oh.
Yeah, it's the best thing, waking up sober. Really
it's so true. And sleep. You know, I just, instead of kind of having anxious sleep, I have really deep sleep. I've slept so much better. But you know, we had a sober Christmas this last time as well. My daughter said to me, you know what, Mum, it just was so easy this year. So I see the ripple effects that it's having on my kids as well. So they're still drinking. They may well drink for quite some time, but, you know, they can make different choices. But I think I'm being a better role model for my family as well. Right. So, yeah.
Thank you so much. The book is No Place to Lie, and my guest was Helen Garlick. I really appreciate it, Helen. Thank you.
It's been great being here. Thanks so much, Janie.
Thank you, Helen. And if you are, you know, if you do want to contact the Samaritans, as Helen said, she's doing that fundraiser. And you know, if you're in that situation, you do want to contact the Samaritans. Just a reminder that the number is 116 123. I wanted to let you know that I've got some great competitions. I constantly forget to tell you about the competitions, but we're lucky enough to have some brands who work with us and offer us some competitions. And, you know, you've got to be in it to win it, right? You've got to enter. And it's simple and it's quick and it's easy. So if you check it, I'll put the link in the show notes. And just a reminder that we've still got some Mockingbird, the alcohol-free tequila, to give away. We've got some Sir James 101 to give away. We featured them last week. We've still got some Jimba. That one's going to be closing soon. It's just the most fantastic drink. Really, really loving that right now. I'm loving all of these. The Low Tide Brewing Company, we've got a mixed pack of those. The Highball Cocktails, we featured them on the podcast a few weeks ago. Wilfred's Aperitif, which is a super unusual, lovely drink. And then Better Without, I interviewed Johnny a few weeks ago. We've got a hoodie to give away and some beers from Sober Source. And I think we've still got some Boucher Kombucha to give away as well. So we've got some great competitions. Have a look at the link there in the show notes. Just a reminder that our Champneys retreats are booking and selling out quite fast. The May one is booked and only has a waiting list now. We've got one at the end of June. I think there's one in July as well, and there's one in September. It's obviously a small number of people, and it's great if you're sober curious, thinking about doing this, or if you've been sober for years and years, because we focus very much on self-care. It's called Self-Care and Sobriety. So it would be great to see you if that resonates. They're based at Champneys in Tring in Hertfordshire. Also, must remind you that my book is out. I think I've told you that before, haven't I? You know, how else is a gal going to promo her book in lockdown? Come on. It's called Happy, Healthy, Sober, Ditch the Booze and Take Control of Your Life. So please leave me a review. If you're able to get a copy, leave me a review, please, if it's nice. And of course, I love getting your feedback on the podcast or the book or anything else you'd like to chat to me about. So you can find me on social media at Janie Lee Grace, or you can obviously check out thesoberclub.com. We are still open for members at the moment. Going to close up soon because I'm going to be focusing on my Platinum Awards, which is the thing that I do every year, where I'm focusing on natural health and well-being products and services. So I don't want to be promoting the Sober Club or, you know, trying to, are we just going to hole up with our members and do some nice stuff for everyone who's in the club? So don't miss out on the opportunity to join us. It's very low cost and high value. Well, of course I would say that, wouldn't I? Some amazing stuff in there. We really do cover so many amazing different topics, and the support and accountability is great. And it's small, by the way. I think sometimes people think that the Sober Club is like one of those kind of big things where you've got thousands of members. Absolutely not. It's very small. So you're kind of nurtured and, you know, looked after. So if you want to be part of it, then check it out, soberclub.com. I'll see you same time next week. Thank you for listening to the Alcohol Free Life podcast, brought to you by The Sober Club. Please rate and review. And if you want support, accountability and inspiration, and you want to live your best life without the booze, check out thesoberclub.com.